listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. I want to thank all of you who called and sent email regarding last night's broadcast. I deeply appreciate your concern. Tonight you're going to hear the audio from a videotape called A Nation Adrift. And I think you might learn something from it. The last 30 minutes of the broadcast, you're going to hear the question and answer period that you were not able to hear at the end of the Dr. Wallach tape that we ran last week. After his presentation, when that tape ended, he went on with questions and answers, and I was able to get an audio track of that question and answer session. So you're going to hear that at the last 30 minutes or so of this broadcast. So sit back, and you might want to take some notes. You're going to hear some really good stuff.
Whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly implore His protection and favor. George Washington.
He who shall introduce into public affairs the principles of Christianity will change the face of the world. Benjamin Franklin.
It cannot be emphasized too strongly or too often that this great nation was founded not by religionists, but by Christians. Not on religion, but on the gospel of Jesus Christ. Patrick Henry.
It is the duty, as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation, to select and prefer Christians for our ruler. John Jay, the first Supreme Court Justice of the United States Supreme Court.
The religion which has introduced civil liberty is the religion of Christ and His apostles. To this we owe our free constitutions of government. Noah Webster.
It is the duty of nations, as well as of men, to own their dependence upon the overruling power of God, to recognize this sublime truth announced in the Holy Scriptures and proven by all history, that those nations only are blessed whose God is the Lord. Abraham Lincoln.
Our forefathers continually acknowledged that God had made and preserved our nation. They were confident that God was blessing their endeavors because they acknowledged Him and sought His aid in all their doings. They warned future generations that the day God was not earnestly revered in America, she would become a byword among nations. We would do well today to review their admonitions and the wisdom that was theirs when they forged the greatest and most prosperous nation in history. Not that we should simply look back, but that we should at least have an elementary grasp of God's sovereign hand behind the history of our nation, which our founding fathers so clearly understood. The result of this journey will hopefully give us a better understanding of where America is today, how she arrived here, and where she must turn at this critical hour. For as Thomas Jefferson once asked, can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed the conviction that these liberties are the gift of God? Jerusalem, 1150. Saladin united the Islamic world under his leadership and began to chip away at the remaining Christian holdings. In 1187, he defeated the Crusaders at the decisive Battle of Hattin and eventually captured Jerusalem itself. When Christopher Columbus stepped ashore in the Americas on October 12, 1492, the scale of his discovery was more extraordinary than even he could imagine. Few events have altered the course of history as drastically as that fateful day when Columbus planted a wooden cross in the sand of a small Caribbean island. But who was this man who discovered America? And what drove him to make that first epic voyage across the green span of darkness? During his first voyage across the Atlantic, Christopher Columbus kept a daily logbook in which he kept a precise account of the expedition.
December 26, 1492. I hope to God that when I come back here from Castile, that I will find gold in such quantity that within 3 years the sovereigns will prepare for and undertake the reconquest of the Holy Land.
Columbus had hoped to open trade routes to the Indies. He had a deep desire to evangelize the nations. And yes, he aspired to the titles and privileges that were certain to come with the discovery of a new world. But more than anything else, he desired to find the means to subsidize a new crusade to free the Holy Land from the grips of the Muslim army. During the time between his third and fourth voyages, Columbus wrote a book entitled The Book of Prophecies. The vast majority of the manuscript deals with the restoration and the future glory of Jerusalem. It appears that he could think of little else. He was obsessed with the notion that the scriptures plainly taught that Christ's final mandate, the Great Commission, could not possibly be fulfilled as long as the menacing specter of the Turks remained in the Holy Land. He wrote,
for the execution of the journey to the Indies, I did not make use of intelligence, mathematics, or maps. It is simply the fulfillment of what Isaiah had prophesied. At the time, I was motivated by the scriptures to go to discover the Indies. I have already petitioned your highnesses to see that all the profits of this, my enterprise, should be spent on the conquest of Jerusalem.
Clearly, the motivations of Columbus were significantly shaped by the eons-long conflict between Christendom and Islam. The evidence is inescapable. He sailed not to discover a new world, but to find a way to recover the old one. So, this last crusader set sail for Jerusalem, and somewhere along the way, he discovered America. European adventurers had been creating settlements and building new societies in America for nearly a century before there were any serious efforts to colonize the land that today constitute the United States. The 16th century was the age of the Protestant Reformation in Europe, and in England, the spirit of the Reformation helped create a population of religious dissenters who rejected both the teachings of the Catholic Church and the newer orthodoxy of the Church of England. These dissenters sought to purify the church of corruption, and they were known, therefore, as Puritans. By the beginning of the 17th century, as persecution of religious nonconformists increased, many began looking outside Europe for a place of refuge. In 1607, The first permanent English settlement in America was at Jamestown, on the coast of what is now the state of Virginia. The second English settlement took root 13 years later, when a group of Puritan separatists established a small colony at Plymouth on the coast of what is now Massachusetts. 10 years later, in 1630, another group of Puritans established the Massachusetts Bay Colony at Boston, and within a decade, English settlement was spreading throughout New England. Jamestown, 1607. Captain John Smith is captured by Indians. After days of captivity, the Indians decided to kill him. As they raised their clubs above him, a 10-year-old girl called Pocahontas rushed forward and laid her head upon Smith's. The chief then spared his life. Jamestown, April 5, 1614. Pocahontas, daughter of King Powhatan, has wed the farmer John Rolfe. Powhatan refused to attend the ceremony, but intimated that he approved the union and would cease the attacks on Jamestown that had been going on since the settlement began. Pocahontas has been taking daily Bible lessons for some time now. Last April, at age 17, she was baptized in her new faith. Plymouth, England, September 16, 1620. The Pilgrims set sail for Virginia in the Mayflower. They were led by William Bradford and William Brewster. Near Cape Cod, November 21, 1620. The Pilgrims drafted a document called the Mayflower Compact, and it is signed by all 41 household heads. It embodied the same principles of government, which would later become the cornerstone of American democracy. The compact states,
"In the name of God, amen, having undertaken for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith."
January 21, 1621. The Pilgrims gather to give thanks to God for a safe passage. The Pilgrims worship from 8 to 12 on Sunday, and again in the afternoon. Plymouth Colony, Autumn 1621. The Pilgrims celebrate their survival at an autumn harvest feast in order to give thanks to God. Governor William Bradford decreed a Thanksgiving celebration in which the settlers would gather with the Indians who helped them get through their first year. The celebration may have gone on for as long as 9 days, and it was a feast of generous proportions. Boston, 1639. The Reverend John Harvard, a Presbyterian minister, gave half of his fortune for the establishment of Harvard College. The college was founded by Puritans, whose hope is that Harvard will succeed in training ministers for the gospel of Jesus Christ. One of the original rules and precepts of Harvard was, "Let every student be plainly instructed, and earnestly pressed to consider well. The main end of his life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life. And therefore, to lay Christ in the bottom as the only foundation of all sound knowledge of learning." Rhode Island, 1683. Rhode Island is now governed by its new charter, which begins, "We submit our persons, lives, and estates unto our Lord Jesus Christ, the King of kings and Lord of lords, and to all those perfect and most absolute laws of his given us in his holy word." Boston, 1700. Judge Samuel Sewall has written a 3-page tract, The Selling of Joseph, the first outright appeal for the abolition of slavery to appear in America. His argument draws a strong parallel between the enforced servitude of African natives and the Old Testament story of Joseph, whose brothers sold him into slavery for 20 pieces of silver. New Haven, 1718. The trustees of the collegiate school have established Yale College because they were unhappy with the religious liberalism they think prevails at Harvard. Students rise at 6 a.m. and follow morning prayers with Bible reading. Williamsburg, Virginia, 1749. George Washington, who is only 16 years old, has been made surveyor for the new county of Culpeper. Philadelphia, 1752. After flying a kite in a thunderstorm and performing other experiments, Benjamin Franklin has concluded that lightning and electricity are identical. Philadelphia, 1753. The Liberty Bell has finally arrived from England. It was in good condition when it arrived, but with the very first stroke of the clapper, the mighty bell cracked. An inscription from Leviticus 25:10 says, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." Ohio River Valley, July 13, 1755. Colonel George Washington, 23, and his British troops were ambushed by about 650 Indians, 100 French, and 100 Canadians. Of the 1,500 colonial and British troops, 977 have been killed. Washington had two horses shot from under him and had four bullet holes in his clothes, yet he came away unharmed. He said later that he believed he was under divine protection from Almighty God. The American Revolution was the most important event in the history of the United States. Not only did it transform the English colonies in America into a free, independent nation, it also did much to determine what kind of nation it would be. The Revolution was, therefore, more than simply a rebellion against English rule and a long, difficult war. It was a process of national self-definition. Noah Webster may have summed it up best in a letter he wrote to James Madison.
"The Christian religion, in its purity, is the basis and the source of all genuine freedom in government. I am persuaded that no civil government of a republican form can exist and be durable in which the principles of Christianity have not a controlling influence."
June 1775. John Adams has formally presented a motion to Congress, and George Washington was unanimously chosen as Commander-in-Chief of the new Continental Army. In accepting the position, he stated,
"I beg it to be remembered by every gentleman in this room that this day declare with the utmost sincerity that I do not think myself equal to the command I'm honored with."
Boston, July 3rd, 1775. General George Washington took command of the Continental Army today. The Southern general has described these Yankees as an exceedingly nasty and dirty people. His army of 17,000 men was more of a ragtag mob than a disciplined fighting force, and did not have sufficient training to perform a traditional pass-and-review for its new chief. No one, enlisted man or officer, seems to be able to give or take orders. To make matters worse, fewer than 12,000 of the general's men are healthy enough for active service. The army's severe shortage of gunpowder, rifles, clothing, and food only confirms what many local observers view as a hopeless military position. As Washington told his friend Patrick Henry,
"From the day I enter upon the command of the American armies, I date my fall and the ruin of my reputation."
On July 4, 1775, the day after Washington formally took command, the following general order was issued.
"The general most earnestly requires and expects a due observance of those articles of war established for the government of the army, which forbid profane cursing, swearing, and drunkenness. And in like manner, he requires and expects of all officers and soldiers not engaged in actual duty, a punctual attendance of divine services, to implore the blessing of heaven upon the means used for our safety and defense."
Philadelphia, July 4, 1776. 3 days of spirited debate ended today as the Continental Congress approved Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence from Great Britain. John Adams called the document the greatest ever debated and predicted that this date would forever be celebrated in America. Adams wrote, "It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty." Trenton, New Jersey, Christmas night, 1776. Defeat after defeat had brought the American Army's morale to its lowest point. Washington knew he had to make a bold strike and go on the offensive, so he chose the pre-dawn hours of December 26 to cross the Delaware River and attack the Hessian garrison. As the troops prepared to get into their boats, a violent snow and hailstorm suddenly came up. This hardship, however, worked in their favor by inducing the enemy sentries to seek cover and reducing visibility to near zero. The Americans arrived so unexpectedly and with such surprise that about 1,000 Hessian prisoners were taken captive after only 45 minutes of battle. New England, 1777. Because of the war, Bibles from England were cut off. Patrick Allison, chaplain of Congress, placed before the body a petition praying for immediate relief. A special congressional committee then ordered that 20,000 Bibles be imported from Holland, Scotland, or elsewhere into the different parts of the states of the Union.
Suppose a nation in some distant region should take the Bible for their only law book, and every member should regulate his conduct by the precepts there exhibited. What a utopia! What a paradise would this region be? John Adams.
Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, December 25th, 1777. Christmas dinner is little more than flour and scraps of beef. The men lie on damp ground in the open air, or in makeshift tents and huts, too weak from cold and hunger to know the difference between waking and sleeping. If a British regiment suddenly appeared at the camp, these men might even be grateful to be taken prisoner. Half of the troops at Valley Forge are without blankets, and a third are without shoes, stockings, or breeches. Washington has written Congress a warning that unless there are new supplies of food and clothing, the army must starve, dissolve, or disperse. Washington later wrote,
"No history now extant can furnish an instance of an army suffering such uncommon hardships as ours has done, and bearing them with the same patience and fortitude. To see men without clothes cover their nakedness, without blankets to lie on, without shoes, for the want of which their marches might be traced by the blood from their feet, and submitting without a murmur, is a proof of patience and obedience which, in my opinion, can scarce be paralleled."
What could possibly have held this army together through this ordeal? How could an inexperienced American army stick together? Most historians agree that the reason for their perseverance at Valley Forge can be attributed to their love of liberty and to their general George Washington and his amazing quality of leadership. With any other leader, the army would have dissolved and vanished. His character and encouragement inspired the army to follow his example. From the beginning, he tirelessly traveled throughout the camp, his very presence bringing strength to the men. It was Washington's character that helped sustain the army. But what sustained Washington? This question could easily be answered by Washington's troops or officers, for they knew his trust was completely in God. On one account, the general's temporary landlord, Isaac Potts, noticed his horse near a secluded grove of trees. Hearing a voice, he approached quietly and saw the general on his knees at prayer. Not wanting to be discovered, he stood motionless until Washington had finished and returned to his headquarters. Potts then hurried and returned home to tell his wife, Sarah.
"If George Washington be not a man of God, I am greatly deceived, and still more shall I be deceived, if God does not, through him, work out a great salvation for America."
March 10th, 1778. Lieutenant Enslin has been tried and found guilty for attempted sodomy with John Monhart, a soldier. General Washington has made it clear that homosexuality would not be tolerated in the military, as he stated,
"His Excellency the Commander-in-Chief approves the sentence and with abhorrence and detestation of such infamous crimes orders Lieutenant Enslin to be drummed out of camp tomorrow morning by all the drummers and fifers in the army, never to return."
Yorktown, Virginia, October 1781. After a series of miraculous victories, the American army finally had British General Cornwallis on the defensive. As a last resort, Cornwallis decided to retreat across the York River. In the official dispatch to his superior, Cornwallis later wrote,
"But at this critical moment, the weather, from being moderate and calm, changed to a violent storm of wind and rain, and drove all the boats, some of which had troops on board, down the river.
Due to this miraculous weather change, Cornwallis was unable to complete his intended retreat and found his force divided when Washington's troops began to move in on them at daybreak. Later that day, he surrendered his forces to General Washington. This essentially marked the end of the war. Francis Tavern in Lower Manhattan, December 4, 1781. The senior officers of the Continental Army were assembled here for a farewell luncheon for General Washington. Ben Talmadge, a lieutenant colonel, was there and kept record of all the details. The general arrived, prompt as always, and from his face, he was as deeply moved as any of them.
With a heart full of gratitude, I now take leave of you. I most devoutly wish that your latter days be as prosperous and happy as your former ones have been glorious and honorable. I cannot come to each of you, but shall feel obliged if each of you will come and take me by the hand.
One by one, the officers shook hands and embraced their commander-in-chief and silently parted. The tears streaming down their face said it all. The simple thought that they were then about to part from the man who had conducted them through a long and bloody war, and under whose conduct the glory and independence of the country had been achieved, and that they would see his face no more in this world, seemed to be utterly insupportable. The disputes between the states was increasing and deepening. Each state was raising or lowering tariffs and coining its own money. Several states even sent their own ambassadors abroad to make trade agreements in competition with each other and with the United States government. In a word, the Union was a mess. George Washington, who passionately wanted no more of public life, now felt compelled to do all he could to save the Union. He started a letter-writing campaign to the men who were in a position to most shape opinions in America. Pleading from deep conviction, he declared that something must be done or the fabric would fall apart. That something turned out to be the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in May 1787, and was originally convened to correct the flaws in the Articles of Confederation. While many were proposing amending the Articles, some men, such as James Madison, George Washington, and Noah Webster, felt a whole new constitution must be drawn up. Upon his arrival in Philadelphia, Washington was the unanimous choice to chair what would become an awesome and momentous occasion. For the first time in history, men would have the opportunity to freely write a new constitution for their own government. Philadelphia, the summer of 1787. Delegates came together to write the Constitution of the United States. 52 of the 55 framers were Orthodox members of one of the established Christian communions, approximately 29 Anglicans, 16 to 18 Calvinists, 2 Methodists, 2 Lutherans, 2 Roman Catholics, 1 Quaker, and 1 open deist, Dr. Franklin, who attended every kind of Christian worship, called for public prayer, and contributed to all denominations. Needless to say, an internal transformation of American society in the direction of a secularized egalitarian state was the furthest thing from the minds of these men.
Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. John Adams.
Once the Constitution had been signed, many members of the convention continued to worry about the scope of the powers granted to the new federal government. James Winthrop of Massachusetts feared that the transfer of power from the states to the federal system would create a permanent aristocracy. And in Baltimore, Luther Martin predicted that the federal form of government would eventually become too expensive. Professor Alexander Tyler wrote,
"The democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves a largesse from the treasury. From that moment on, the majority will always vote for the candidates promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy."
The ratification of the Constitution and the launching of the federal government in 1789 completed the first phase of the building of a new nation in America. A political system was now in place that would last for more than two centuries with only modest changes. Americans in the first half of the 19th century developed a deep reverence for the memory of the Revolution, for the Constitution and its framers, and for what they considered the distinctive virtues and special destiny of their society. President John Quincy Adams may have summed it up best when he stated,
"The highest glory of the American Revolution was this, that it connected in one indissoluble bond the principles of civil government with the principles of Christianity."
New York, April 30th, 1789. George Washington was inaugurated as the first president of the United States. In his inaugural address, he stated,
"It would be peculiarly improper to omit in this first official act my fervent supplication to that almighty being who rules over the universe, presides in the councils of nations, and whose providential aids can supply every human defect. No people can be bound to acknowledge and adore the invisible hand which conducts the affairs of men more than the people of the United States."
In office, Washington was a very mild nationalist who did not think of the presidency as a source of innovations in policy. He envisioned the government to be little more than a referee and expected American society to prosper on its own. Washington, D.C., 1802. President Thomas Jefferson, in his annual address to Congress, restated his plan to streamline the federal government. Government should shrink to fill its proper role, he said. A few plain duties to be performed by a few servants. Washington, D.C., 1805. In his second inaugural address, President Jefferson emphasized his past and present concern on the issue of taxes. In his speech, he proposed that Federalist-inspired internal taxes be completely eliminated. July 4, 1826. The 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. On that day, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, both heroes of the Revolution, both former presidents, both beloved symbols of the nation's divine origin, died within a few hours of each other at their homes in Virginia and Massachusetts. To many Americans, the timing of their passing seemed to confirm that theirs was a nation especially graced by God. 1828. No single American has contributed so much to American education as has Noah Webster. He worked for 26 years on his An American Dictionary of the English Language. It was the first American dictionary and the grandfather of all others. In 1783, he wrote his famous Blueback Speller, which did more for American education than any other single book except the Bible. It would sell over 100 million copies in a century. Noah Webster stated,
"Every civil government is based upon some religion or philosophy of life. Education in a nation will propagate the religion of that nation. In America, the foundational religion was Christianity, and it was sown in the hearts of Americans through the home, private, and public schools for centuries. Our liberty, growth, and prosperity was the result of a biblical philosophy of life. Our continued freedom and success is dependent upon our educating the youth of America in the principles of the Christian religion."
Rochester, New York, 1830. Charles Finney, who as a young lawyer once offered only scorn and ridicule to Christianity, has now become perhaps the greatest evangelist in the nation's history. It is estimated that the preaching of Finney resulted in the conversion of 500,000 lives. He once stated,
"The church must take the right ground in regard to politics. Politics are a part of religion in a country like this. And Christians must do their duty to the country as a part of their duty to God. And God will bless a nation according to the course Christians take in politics."
Washington, D.C., 1843. John Quincy Adams becomes the first president to have his picture taken. He has been out of the White House for 14 years and is now devoting his congressional career to raising a consistent and forceful voice against slavery as a moral evil. Manhattan, New York, 1857. A man of prayer, Jeremiah Lanthier, started a prayer meeting in the upper room of the consistory building of the Dutch Reformed Church in Manhattan. From a population of 1 million, only 6 people showed up. But the following week, there were 14, and then 23. They soon filled the Dutch Reformed Church, the Methodist Church, then every public building in downtown New York. Newspaper editor Horace Greeley sent a reporter to all of the meetings to see how many men were praying. In 1 hour, he could only get to 12 meetings, but he counted 6,100 men. Soon, 10,000 people a week were converted in New York City. Washington, D.C., November 6, 1860. Despite his own gloomy forecast, Abraham Lincoln was elected President of the United States. During the campaign, Southerners had warned that the Cotton Belt states would secede if Lincoln, that black Republican, were elected. The election of Abraham Lincoln to the presidency was a heavy blow to those Southerners who hoped for a peaceful resolution of the nation's sectional conflicts. A Northern Republican, Lincoln represented a party committed since its origins to preventing any extension of slavery. As the Southern states began to secede from the Union late in 1860, many people in both regions assumed and hoped that the North would let them go in peace. Others believed secession was a temporary crisis. In April 1861, forces of the new Confederate States of America opened fire on Fort Sumter, which was the last military installation in the South still under the control of the United States government. People on both sides assumed that any armed conflict would be brief and limited. Instead, it became the bloodiest conflict in the nation's history. More than 600,000 Americans died in the Civil War, more than had died in all of the country's 20th century conflicts combined. Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, July 3, 1863. Today is the third day of the bloodiest battle of the war. General Robert E. Lee sent 14,000 men under General George Pickett against the Federal Center. Pickett formed a battle line a mile wide. It may have been the most spectacular sight in the history of warfare.
Forward!
The Confederate Army began its advance. They had nearly a mile of open field to cross to get at the Federals, and the Bluecoats simply tore them to shreds. A few hundred men reached the Union line, but they were killed or captured. During the 3 days of battle, Southern casualties came to 20,000 men, and the North lost some 23,000 men.
Intercessory prayer is our mightiest weapon and the supreme call for all Christians today. I pleadingly urge our people everywhere to pray, believing that prayer is the greatest contribution that our people can make in this critical hour. I humbly urge that we take time to pray. Let there be prayer at sunup, at noonday, at sundown, at midnight, all through the day. Let us all pray for our children, our youth, our aged, our pastors, our homes, and our churches. Let us pray for those who have never known Jesus Christ. Let prayer be our passion. Let prayer be our practice. Robert E. Lee.
I've been driven many times upon my knees by the overwhelming conviction that I had nowhere else to go. My own wisdom and that of all about me seemed insufficient for that day. Abraham Lincoln.
Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, November 20th, 1863. Looking out over a battlefield still strewn with carcasses of horses shot more than 4 months ago, President Abraham Lincoln dedicated a cemetery for the nation's neglected dead. En route to Gettysburg, he confronted a man who had lost his son in battle there. Lincoln told him,
"When I think of the sacrifices of life yet to be offered, and the hearts and homes yet to be desolated before this dreadful war is over, my heart is like lead within me, and I feel at times like hiding in deep darkness."
This deep personal grief animated Lincoln's remarks at Gettysburg. Words can do little to stop the casualties. Nonetheless, the crowd of 15,000 on Cemetery Hill strained to hear some consolation.
67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we will God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Shortly before his death, an Illinois clergyman asked Lincoln, "Do you love Jesus?" Mr. Lincoln solemnly replied, "When I left Springfield, I asked the people to pray for me. I was not a Christian. When I buried my son, the severest trial of my life, I was not a Christian. But when I went to Gettysburg and saw the graves of thousands of our soldiers, I then and there consecrated myself to Christ. Yes, I do love Jesus." Washington, D.C., April 14, 1865. President Lincoln was shot while he sat in a rocking chair next to his wife in a box in Ford's Theater during a performance of the play Our American Cousin. Laramie, Wyoming Territory, September 6, 1870. Mrs. Louisa Swain today became the first woman in the nation to cast a legal ballot, voting under equal suffrage laws passed here last year. Nashville, Tennessee, 1878. Vanderbilt University oust Professor Alexander Winchell for teaching scientific contradictions to the Bible. Is a nation of immigrants, a country inhabited by people whose ancestors all shared the painful experience of being uprooted from their native land to start a new life in a strange world. From this common experience, America has earned a reputation as a land of opportunity for the world's oppressed, and a melting pot where a variety of ethnic, religious, and racial groups have mixed together to form a new culture. The post-Civil War era would usher in the development of railroads and ocean liners, the rise of industry, the growth of cities, and the explosion of technical and scientific knowledge. 25 years after the death of Lincoln, America had become, in the quantity of her products, the first manufacturing nation in the world. What England had accomplished in 100 years, the United States had achieved in half the time. Cities were growing so rapidly that public services could not keep up with demand. Roads, sewers, transportation systems, housing, social services, government bureaucracies, public health systems, all were plunged into something approaching chaos as they strained to keep up with the changes around them. There was a growing sense that government, local, state, and ultimately national, had to play a larger role in the life of society than it had in the past. The belief in the ideal of the autonomous, self-reliant individual, an ideal that had been at the heart of America's image of itself since the founding of the Republic, must now compete with an increasingly interdependent society in which individual liberties would be balanced against public needs and desires. Washington, D.C., 1892. In Church of the Holy Trinity versus United States, the Supreme Court issued 87 precedents in coming to their decision, which states, "Our laws and institutions must necessarily be based upon and embody the teachings of the Redeemer of mankind. It is impossible that it should be otherwise. And in this sense, and to this extent, our civilization and our institutions are emphatically Christian. This is historically true. From the discovery of this continent to the present hour, we find everywhere a clear recognition of the same truth." These and many other matters add a volume of unofficial declarations to the mass of organic utterances that this is a Christian nation. The first big commercial success of American film was The Great Train Robbery, and that one reel of celluloid turned the industry from a gimmicky side street peep show into the first new medium of artistic expression the world had known since the printing press. Most of the early films were westerns, but the trouble was that they were easterns with painted backdrops. Wise men of the early cinema decided to move west. Samuel Goldwyn of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and United Artists, longtime tycoon and producer Jesse L. Lasky, and the screen's classic master of multitudinous magnitude, Cecil B. DeMille. The three future moguls needed space, sun, sky, and authentic backgrounds. Arizona was a natural choice. Not so natural was the choice of northern Arizona. When the three tycoons detrained at Flagstaff, they found not only sun, sky, but also snow. Shaking the snow from their patent leather shoes and gray silk spats, they took the next train out and ended up on a sandy strip of soil with the archaic and unlikely name of Hollywood. Because of a snowfall in the Arizona highlands, a chunk of Southern California became the movie mecca of the world. Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, December 17, 1903. Orville and Wilbur Wright hauled their gasoline-powered flyer up Kill Devil Hill this morning. After winning a coin toss, the 32-year-old Orville climbed aboard. The 13-horsepower engine then came sputtering to life and took off on a flight that lasted 12 seconds over a distance of 120 feet. New York City, 1904. A drastic cut in steerage rates has allowed Europeans to board a steamship with $10 in their pockets and arrive at Ellis Island less than a month later. If a decent job awaits them, they will earn the price of their passage in a week. Atlantic City, New Jersey, 1905. The ministers of this city reported that of a population of 50,000, they knew of only 50 adults who were unconverted. The revival of 1905 in the United States was linked to the famous Welsh revival of 1904, which swept like a tidal wave over Wales, where 100,000 people were converted in a five-month period. The social impact of the Wales revival was astounding. Judges were presented with white gloves. They had no cases to try. No rapes, no robberies, no murders, no burglaries, no embezzlements, nothing. The district consuls held emergency meetings to discuss what to do with the police now that they were unemployed. Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C., 1906. I can do one of two things, President Theodore Roosevelt has said. I can be President of the United States, or I can control Alice. I cannot possibly do both. Today, the greater burden was lifted. His eldest daughter, who has smoked cigarettes in public and once raced about in an automobile in the company of free men, was wed today in a splendid White House ceremony. 1914. Henry Ford has announced a revolutionary new method of producing automobiles called the assembly line. The secret was to keep everything in motion, Ford said. Our idea is that men should aid machines, whereas old production methods said machines should aid men. Ford is now producing a new car every 93 minutes. 1 on April 6, 1917, amidst a burst of patriotic fervor. A year and a half later, the war was over. The United States was the only nation to emerge from the conflict stronger than when it had entered, and was now clearly the preeminent power in the world. Hollywood, California, 1915. D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation is the most expensive and longest film ever made. Many say the film is a landmark in cinema history, as motion pictures will now be regarded as an art form. New York City, 1915. Margaret Sanger has founded the National Birth Control League. Later, in 1942, after three name changes, it would become known as Planned Parenthood. In her first newspaper, The Woman Rebel, she wrote,
"Birth control appeals to the advanced radical because it is calculated to undermine the authority of the Christian churches. I look forward to seeing humanity free someday of the tyranny of Christianity, no less than capitalism."
She also published three articles on the necessity for social revolution and two defending political assassinations. Margaret Sanger was so militant that she was served with a subpoena indicting her on three counts for the publication of lewd and indecent material in violation of the federal Comstock laws. She then fled the country under an assumed name and a forged passport. In 1919, an article appeared in Margaret Sanger's magazine, The Birth Control Review. In it, she stated that her goal was to create a race of thoroughbreds by encouraging more children from the fit and less from the unfit. In her book, The Pivot of Civilization, she called for the elimination of human undergrowth, for the segregation of morons, misfits, and the maladjusted, and for the sterilization of genetically inferior races. In the years that followed, many other articles in her magazines would leave no doubt as to her racist views. A 1923 edition of her magazine spoke out on the restriction of immigration on a racial basis. In 1933, the Review published an article on sterilization by Ernst Rudin, who was Hitler's director of genetic sterilization and a founder of the Nazi Society for Racial Hygiene. Later that same year, she published an article by Leon Whitney entitled Selective Sterilization, which adamantly praised and defended the Third Reich's racial programs. Margaret Sanger was also involved in what became known as the Negro Project, in which they stated that the masses of Negroes, particularly in the South, still breed carelessly and disastrously. with the result that the increase among Negroes, even more than among whites, is from that portion of the population least intelligent and fit. The aim of the project was to hire 3 or 4 colored ministers to travel to various black enclaves and propagandize for birth control. Margaret wrote,
"The most educated approach to the Negro is through a religious appeal. We do not want word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population. And the minister is the man who can straighten out that idea if it ever occurs to any of their more rebellious members."
The project turned out to be quite successful. Scores of blacks across the country happily fell into step behind Margaret and the racist she had placed on her Negro Advisory Council. May 19, 1917. Roger Nash Baldwin has founded the Bureau of Conscientious Objectors for the purpose of helping draft dodgers develop practical strategies of resistance and to provide them with financial and legal support. On October 1, 1917, he renamed the organization, this time as the National Civil Liberties Bureau. Soon afterwards, the post office would declare his propaganda unmailable because of its radical and subversive views. His offices were then raided by the FBI and its files confiscated. 12 days later, Roger was called to register for the draft. He resisted the draft and was promptly arrested and brought to trial. While in court, he professed his commitment to anarchism and his allegiance to socialist reform. He was then sentenced to 1 year in the penitentiary. After his release from prison, he set about trying to salvage what was left of his Civil Liberties Bureau. On January 20, 1920, Roger Baldwin moved to offices on West 13th Street in New York and shared them with the Communist Party's New Masses tabloid. He also reincorporated and renamed it for the third and final time as the American Civil Liberties Union, or the ACLU. Some of the original members of the ACLU were Norman Thomas, who was 6 times the Socialist Party's candidate for president, William Foster, chairman of the Communist Party USA, Max Eastman, editor of the Communist Party's paper, The Masses, Harry Ward, who, according to the Congressional Record, maintained membership and affiliation with over 200 communist or communist front organizations, and Clarence Darrow, who dazzled the nation as a flamboyant and articulate defense attorney and anti-Christian crusader. During the first 60 years, a full 90% of the cases that the ACLU defended involved communists. As a result, the ACLU was stigmatized as a communist front organization itself. Roger Baldwin stated,
"I am for socialism, disarmament, and ultimately for abolishing the state itself as an instrument of violence and compulsion. I seek social ownership of property, the abolition of the property class, and sole control by those who produce wealth. Communism is the goal. It all sums up into one single purpose, the abolition of dog-eat-dog under which we live."
Roger Baldwin would also join scores of front organizations, which years later, in 1976, he would admit were essentially recruiting centers for the Communist Party. New York City, 1917. 1.5 million people came to hear evangelist Billy Sunday during a 10-week crusade here. Billy had been a Major League Baseball player with the Chicago White Sox before receiving Christ. He continued in pro ball 4 more years until resigning for full-time evangelism. Some 2 million, it is said, gave their hearts to God during the Sunday campaigns, which spanned a quarter of a century.
"I'll fight it as long as I have a tooth, and when I'm old, I'm fistless, I'm footless, I'm toothless, I'll do it till I behold the glory and hit those home to perdition."
Boston, 1918. The Boston Red Sox clinched the 6th and final game of the World Series with a 2-1 victory over the Chicago Cubs. But fans are still talking about the remarkable pitching of Babe Ruth. When Chicago scored in the 4th game, Ruth's record of 29 2/3 shutout innings was ended. He's also quite a hitter. Washington, D.C., 1919. Americans have always looked to the government primarily as a source of protection from foreign or domestic enemies, and not as the provider of services and benefits. However, many are now embracing the very centralized government the Founding Fathers urged them to fear and hold in check. Woodrow Wilson warned, The history of liberty is a history of limitations of governmental power, not the increase of it. When we resist, therefore, the concentration of power, we are resisting the powers of death, because concentration of power is what always precedes the destruction of human liberties.
We're going inside them. We're going outside them. And when we get them on the run, we're going to keep them on the run. And we're not going to fire unless our secondary comes up too close. But don't forget, man, we're going to get them on the run. We're going to go. Heading on to the scout until we go right goal line.
Pasadena, California, January 1st, 1925. Newt Rockne, who lifted Notre Dame from obscurity to football greatness, saw his Fighting Irish win the biggest prize of all by upsetting Stanford 27-10 in the Rose Bowl. Dayton, Tennessee, 1925. The so-called trial of the century was indeed that. William Jennings Bryan was asked to serve for the prosecution because of his crusade against the theory of evolution. ACLU lawyer Clarence Darrow led the defense and argued that it is bigotry for public schools to teach only one theory of origins. The ACLU's official position is that both creation and evolution should be taught in schools. New York City, 1925. Margaret Sanger, whose organization would later be named Planned Parenthood, has organized a birth control conference here. She stated,
"The government of the United States deliberately encourages and even makes necessary by its laws the breeding of idiots, defective, diseased, feeble-minded, and criminal classes. Year by year, more money is expended to maintain an increasing race of morons, which threatens the very foundation of our civilization."
New York City, 1927. The first public demonstration in America of the new invention, television, has shown its potential not only as an entertainment. Thomas Alva Edison marked the 50th anniversary of the invention of the phonograph. On this day, he repeated the first words recorded in sound.
The first words I spoke in the original phonograph. A little piece of practical poetry. Mary had a little lamb, it squeaked quite a flow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
Long Island, New York, May 21st, 1927. Charles Lindbergh made history today by flying his single-engine plane, the Spirit of St. Louis, non-stop to Paris without sleep or radio contact in 33 and a half hours. Beginning in 1921, the American economy began a period of unprecedented prosperity and expansion that continued almost uninterrupted for 8 years. To observers around the globe, the American economy was one of the wonders of the world. Then, in the aftermath of a stock market crash in October 1929 and a gradual weakening of the economy, the industrial edifice collapsed and the nation plunged into the severest and most prolonged economic crisis in its history. The Great Depression, as it quickly became known, frustrated the business world. Hundreds of thousands of farmers lost their land and joined the growing number of citizens roaming the landscape looking for work, work that did not exist. Millions of families accustomed to security, even affluence, experienced deprivation and economic fear for the first time. Out of desperation, the self-reliant American of the past was now willing to relinquish his sovereignty and place his future into the hands of a government that would grow into the bureaucratic nightmare that our forefathers so often warned against. Washington, D.C., November 1932. Franklin Roosevelt pledged a New Deal for the American people. They believed him and elected him the 32nd president. During the campaign, he seemed to contradict himself. At one point, he proposed a 25% cut in government expenditures, but later, he said he would consider deficit spending if it were necessary. Contradictions notwithstanding, political experts say that his popularity stems from his willingness to consider any economic or political program, regardless of its ideological origin.
I shall ask the Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis. Broad executive power.
He recently told an audience at Oglethorpe University, "The country needs and demands bold, persistent experimentation." Washington, D.C., 1935. President Roosevelt signed into law the Social Security Act. However, its critics say that it is yet another step by the president to Sovietize America.
This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 50 millions of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health.
Washington, D.C., January 1936. A member of the president's own party, Democrat Alfred E. Smith, says that Franklin Roosevelt is a socialist and is trying to pattern the United States in the Soviet Union's image.
A few timid people who fear progress will try to give you new and strange names for what we are doing. Sometimes they will call it fascism, and sometimes communism, and sometimes regimentation, and sometimes socialism. But in so doing, they are trying to make very complex and theoretical something that is really very simple and very practical. I believe that what we are doing today is a necessary fulfillment of what Americans have always been doing, a fulfillment of old and tested American ideals.
By the end of the 1930s, the Roosevelt administration had produced the beginnings of a new liberal ideology that would shape reform efforts for decades to come, an ideology that remains at the center of American political debate even half a century later. Miami, 1937. Amelia Earhart was the first woman to cross the Atlantic alone in 1932. Now she would try to fly around the world. On June 1, 1937, she and navigator Fred Noonan took off from Miami. On July 2nd, they left New Guinea for the final leg of their journey.
You're listening to WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA.
The last words heard from her were, "Gas is low, and we are running online." But her voice was not heard again. 3 weeks before her 40th birthday, Amelia Earhart was gone. Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, December 7, 1941. The Japanese Empire, using aircraft carriers within 300 miles of Pearl Harbor, launched wave after wave of attacks against soldiers, sailors, and airmen who had just started into their Sunday morning routines. The first wave of Japanese aircraft consisted of 49 high-level bombers, 51 dive bombers, and 51 fighters.
December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
Within 2 hours, the Navy lost 2,000 men killed and 710 wounded, while the Army and Marines lost 327 killed and 433 wounded. New York, 1942.
Margaret Sanger has once again changed the name of her organization. This time, she is calling it the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. One of the arguments for the new name is to convey a clean, wholesome, family-oriented image. However, she once denounced marriage as a degenerate institution. And in her book, Women and the New Race, she said that the most merciful thing a large family can do to one of its infant members is to kill it. Japan, August 6, 1945. As the B-29 bomber moved over Hiroshima, it let loose a 10,000-pound bomb from a height of 31,000 feet. Within a few seconds, temperatures at the center reached 5,400 degrees Fahrenheit. 80,000 people were killed, many within a second of the explosion and its accompanying firestorm. In his mission book, the co-pilot Robert Lewis wrote, "My God, what have we done?" Tokyo, September 2, 1945. Aboard the battleship Missouri, Japanese officials surrendered to representatives of the Allied powers, led by General Douglas MacArthur, thus ending the most devastating war the world has ever seen. During World War II, some 400,000 Americans were killed and 500,000 were wounded.
Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world, and that God will preserve it always.
Washington, D.C., June 14, 1954. President Eisenhower signed a congressional resolution today that added the words, "Under God," to the Pledge of Allegiance.
It will begin with this president taking a firm, simple resolution.
The resolution changed the phrase, "One nation, indivisible," to "One nation, under God, indivisible." At the signing, the president said that it served to rededicate the nation to its divine origins. New York City, October 1954. Comic book publishers banded together to establish the Comics Code Authority, a self-regulating body created to assure parents of the wholesome content of their children's reading material. The adverse impact of comic books on the emotional development of children was explored by Senator Estes Kefauver's committee hearings on juvenile delinquency, which resulted in public outcry against comic books. New York City, 1956. Elvis Presley is a phenomenon. Music critics call him unspeakably untalented and vulgar. But while adults recoil in horror from his high-energy pelvic gyrations, teenage fans bought 7 million copies of his records this year. March 1958. Elvis Presley may rock America, but he is ready and willing to serve it as well when he was called up for duty in the Army. Washington, D.C., 1958. A United States Supreme Court justice was quoted as saying, "If the court doesn't stop talking about separation of church and state, then people will start thinking it's part of the Constitution." 1960. The ACLU launched several legal initiatives to prohibit nativity scenes, Christmas decorations, or the singing of carols in public schools or on public property. Spartanburg, South Carolina, 1960. Senator Barry Goldwater says, "I fear Washington and centralized government more than I do Moscow." Cape Canaveral, February 20, 1962. John Glenn became the first American to make an orbital flight by circling the Earth three times. In September 1962, President Kennedy expressed the hope that before long, an American might land on the moon.
"We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard."
Washington, D.C., June 25, 1962. For the first time in American history, ACLU lawyers have convinced the United States Supreme Court that a prayer recited each day in public schools constitutes an unlawful establishment of religion. It was also the first time in U.S. history that the court did not quote previous legal cases or historical incidents in reaching its decision. United States, 1963. Mrs. Betty Friedan, a 42-year-old psychologist and housewife, has published a book titled The Feminine Mystique. She has concluded that women are unfulfilled and must develop their identities. Her solution? A new life plan for women that emphasizes work outside the home. Washington, D.C., 1963. For the first time in the 200-year history of our country, Bibles have been removed from the public schools of America. In the case of Abington versus Shemp, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that if portions of the New Testament were read without explanation, they could be and had been psychologically harmful to the child.
The Bible is the cornerstone of liberty. A student's perusal of the sacred volume will make him a better citizen, a better father, a better husband. Thomas Jefferson.
The Bible is the rock on which our republic rests. President Andrew Jackson.
In my view, the Christian religion is the most important and one of the first things in which all children under a free government ought to be instructed. Noah Webster.
Washington, D.C., 1963. In the largest civil rights demonstration ever, more than 200,000 people gathered to hear Dr. Martin Luther King describe his vision of the future of America. Dallas, November 22, 1963. President John Kennedy and his wife arrived here today for meetings with the state Democratic leaders.
The president's car is now turning onto Elm Street, and it will be only a matter of minutes before he arrives at the trademark. I was off Dallas Freeway earlier, and even the freeway was jam-packed with spectators waiting their chance to see the president as he made his way towards the trademark.
As the presidential motorcade passed the Texas School Book Depository, the unbelievable happened. Three rifle shots rang out, and the president was dead. Many would grieve his death even decades later. As these words were spoken 238,000 miles through the blackness of space, humanity was awed by the news that two American astronauts, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin Jr., had landed on the moon.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Washington, D.C., January 22, 1973. In a Texas case, Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court today overturned all state laws that restrict or deny a woman's right to obtain an abortion.
Why are you carrying this sign that says stop the Holocaust?
It's unlawful to destroy that egg of the bald eagle, but it's okay to destroy babies.
The Bible teaches us that we shall not kill. We believe in setting up for life, not for death.
Why do young girls like you feel so strongly about this? You believe abortion is murder. I'm marching here today because my mother didn't abort.
Kids are beautiful. They had abortion around the corner and wouldn't be here right now.
Justice Harry Blackmun, author of the 64-page document, said that objection to abortion came mainly from two sources, the Oath of Hippocrates and Christianity. Since the oath specifically forbids abortion, the court wrestled with its influence, but concluded that, in the context of general opinion, ancient religions did not bar abortion. As for Christianity, it was dismissed by the court because of the so-called separation of church and state. In effect, the court omitted 2,000 years of Judeo-Christian influence and reached back into paganism to find the basis for its moral judgment. Justice Byron White dissented on the decision and said, "I find nothing in the language or history of the Constitution to support the court's judgment." 1976. The ACLU has brought suit in New Jersey in an effort to prohibit Christmas pageants in the public schools. Washington, D.C., 1980. The American Civil Liberties Union has won another Supreme Court victory. In the case of Stone versus Graham, the ACLU charged that a Kentucky school board removed the Ten Commandments from the walls of public schools. In reaching its decision, the court stated, "If the posted copies of the Ten Commandments are to have any effect at all, it will be to induce the school children to read, meditate upon, perhaps to venerate and obey the Ten Commandments. This is not a permissible objective." James Madison was the chief architect of the Constitution. He is the man who is the most responsible for what is contained in the Constitution. He said,
"We have staked the future of American civilization upon the capacity of each and all of us to govern ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God."
Washington, D.C., 1981. In one of his final actions as president, Jimmy Carter awarded the Medal of Freedom to ACLU founder Roger Baldwin. The Medal of Freedom is the nation's highest civilian honor. A few of the official policy decisions of the ACLU are as follows. They support the legalization of child pornography, but oppose voluntary school prayer. They support the legalization of drugs, but oppose sobriety checkpoints. They support tax exemptions for Satanists, but oppose tax exemption for churches. They support the legalization of prostitution, but oppose religious displays in public. They support abortion on demand, but oppose medical safety regulations for abortions. And the list goes on and on. 1985. In a 6-3 ruling, the Supreme Court struck down an Alabama law that required a moment of silent meditation at the beginning of each school day. 1986. Yeager versus Douglas County. The ACLU has won another court victory that forbids religious invocations before high school football games. 1987. Abandoning all pretense of political neutrality, the ACLU led the smear campaign designed to deny Judge Robert Bork confirmation to the Supreme Court.
When a judge goes beyond this and reads entirely new values into the Constitution, values the framers and the ratifiers did not put there, he deprives the people of their liberty. That liberty, which the Constitution clearly envisions, is the liberty of the people to set their own social agenda through the processes of democracy.
Mark Campisano was a former Supreme Court clerk for Justice William Brennan. He stated, "An accounting of the ACLU's caseload suggests that the organization is an ideological chameleon, that beneath the protective coloration of civil liberties, the ACLU is pursuing a very different agenda, one contrary to the basic principles of American constitutional democracy." America, late 1980s. For most of the past decade, Planned Parenthood shifted its focus from community-based clinics to school-based clinics and again targeted inner-city minority neighborhoods. Of the more than 100 school-based clinics that have opened nationwide in the last decade, none have been at substantially all-white schools. None have been at suburban middle-class schools. All have been at black, minority, or ethnic schools. According to U.S. Department of Health and Human Service figures, in most black communities today, abortions outnumber births by as much as 3-1. Dr. Alan Guttmacher, the man who immediately succeeded Margaret Sanger as president of Planned Parenthood, once said, "We are merely walking down the path that Mrs. Sanger carved out for us." Faye Waddleton, president of the organization during the decade of the 80s, has claimed that she is proud to be walking in the footsteps of Margaret Sanger. And the president of the New York affiliate is Alexander Sanger, her grandson. Thus, virtually everything that Margaret Sanger believed, everything she practiced, and everything she aspired to is reflected in the organization and program of Planned Parenthood even today. Los Angeles, November 8, 1991. America is shocked by the revelation that basketball star Irvin Magic Johnson has tested positive for the virus that causes AIDS. President Bush today called him a hero. Ohio, September 1992. Dr. Martin Haskell has presented a paper on a new abortion technique called dilation and extraction, or DNX, to the National Abortion Federation. The DNX procedure is performed on late-term pregnancies and includes the following steps. An abortionist, guided by an ultrasound screen, uses forceps to deliver the entire baby except the head, which cannot fit through the opening of the cervix at this stage in pregnancy. The baby is then stabbed through the base of the skull with blunt surgical scissors. A tube is inserted to vacuum out the baby's brains. The skull collapses and passes easily through the cervical opening.
And, you know, that was probably where the love affair with the fetus may have come in, because I looked on it as an affair.
April 1993. Surgeon General nominee Jocelyn Elders is quoted as saying, "I tell every girl that when she goes out on a date, put a condom in her purse.
And I want you to know that given a choice, if you, between a young woman coming in saying that I'm pregnant and whether or not they use contraceptives, most mothers I know would get up at midnight and go out and buy them for their children themselves."
She was also quoted as saying, "We taught them what to do in the front seat of the car. Now it's time to teach them what to do in the back seat." When asked about the increase in teen pregnancies and the increase of syphilis among teens, she attributed it to poverty, ignorance, and the Bible Belt mentality.
But you probably would have said very religious, non-Christian white.
February 1993. Roberta Actenberg, an avowed lesbian activist, has been appointed to a prominent position in the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Actenberg has a long history of radical activities and spearheaded an attack on the Boy Scouts in San Francisco. She said of the Boy Scouts, "Do we want children learning the values of an organization that provides character building exclusively for straight, God-fearing male children?" June 1993. Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been appointed to the United States Supreme Court. Based on a report she co-authored and on her previous decisions, the following are a few of the positions she has expressed in the past. The traditional family concept of the husband as breadwinner and wife as homemaker must be eliminated. The age of consent for sexual acts must be lowered to 12 years of age. Prostitution must be legalized. All boy and all girl organizations, such as the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts, must be sexually integrated. August 1993. The National Endowment for the Arts agreed to fund 3 gay and lesbian film festivals. The NEA gave $17,500 to festivals in Pittsburgh, New York, and Los Angeles. Larry Horn, executive director of the Gay and Lesbian Media Coalition, stated, "It's a sign of validation from the highest office for arts funding in this country." September 19, 1993. Members of Hamilton Square Baptist Church in San Francisco were attending their Sunday evening service when they were attacked viciously by the gay activist groups ACT UP and Queer Nation. The church was surrounded by more than 100 rioters who screamed obscenities and roughed up parishioners who were attempting to attend the service. Emily Wagman and her 6-year-old daughter Jessica were surrounded.
They were right into your face. They were just screaming all these words, you know, the profanity and bigots and cursing, and he was terrified.
Tim Wright, the 9-year-old son of Associate Pastor David Wright, heard the protesters shout, "We want your children."
He was quite hysterical about it, and, you know, saying, "Well, they're after me. It's me they want."
The 3 or 4 police on hand were nearly pushed through the door by the horde of homosexuals. An 8-year-old retarded girl was so frightened that she fell down a flight of stairs. Hamilton Square Pastor David Innes tried to get police to take action, but police would not make arrests. 77-year-old Ruth Brown, blind since birth, was horrified.
So when I heard all this racket, I thought they were shooting, and oh, I just went to pieces. Then I thought, oh my goodness, what if they'd come in here? Because I knew if they got in here, they'd kill somebody. I just knew it.
In 1814, Sir John David Michaelis authored a 4-volume legal work, which remains one of the most comprehensive studies ever written on the subject of homosexuality. He states, "Whoever wishes to ruin a nation has only to get the vice of sodomy introduced, for it is extremely difficult to extirpate it where it has once taken root. And once it has a footing in any country, however powerful and flourishing, we may venture as politicians to predict that the foundation of its future decline is laid, and that after some 100 years, it will no longer be the same powerful country it is at present. We are engaged in a great civil war. It is perhaps the most crucial war in our nation's history. This is not a war being fought with guns and grenades and bombs. It is a war of values. It is a war of ideas. It is a war of concepts. It is a war for preeminence and control of our culture and its methods of communicating. The political process has been corrupted by ungodly men and by the neglect of God's people to be the moral conscience of our leaders. As a result, the secular world has been successful in twisting the concept of the separation of church and state to mean separation of God from government. They have convinced us that the church should not expose corruption and immoral legislation, and that Christians should not be active in politics. Our Constitution forbids the establishment of a state religion, yet the federal government itself is subsidizing the public schools of our nation with millions of tax dollars to teach humanism, which was defined as a religion in a 1961 Supreme Court ruling. All of our laws, until recently, were based on biblical law. Our legislators are legislating immorality, and we, as Christians, are endorsing them with our silence. Today, we must stand up for God in our democratic republic, using the voice He has granted us. A national rebirth can occur if God's people are willing to pay the price of personal involvement. Such has been the case in the various spiritual awakenings of past generations. The rebirth of America is more than a notable aspiration. It is a desperate need, and by God's grace, may become a glorious reality at this crucial hour.
Now that concludes part one of tonight's broadcast, folks, and stay tuned now for part two, coming up immediately.
Play doctor, you can make your own determination whether or not you have a fracture or somebody you love has a fracture by putting a tuning fork on there. You can go into any drugstore, you get, or a bookstore at the medical school, the biology school at the university, you get a little C tuning fork, tap it, and while it's still vibrating, touch it to a fracture you think is a fracture. If it's real painful, you know it's a fracture. You can also do the same thing with a tooth. If the fracture of the tooth is down into the root, you will jump out of your seat. Okay, this gentleman's got a low platelet count because the doctors say his antibodies are attacking his own platelets. Do you take vitamins and minerals? What do you take? He just started. Okay. She's honest. He just started. Okay, this guy just started taking vitamins and minerals. So what I want you to do is take Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula for 2 months and then go back and have another platelet count. The reason why I say that is your bone marrow that produces platelets, that produces white blood cells and red blood cells, requires 90 nutrients to do that. The first thing you're going to want to do is give you some chemotherapy. cancer. You want to give you chemotherapy or prednisone or something to calm that down. Try Dr. Wong's finger arthritis formula for 2 months first and go back in and get that checked. Anybody else? Yes, in the blue. The Dr. Wallace Big Arthritis Formula is written in the book Let's Play Doctor, but it's under arthritis and osteoporosis. But instead of saying Knox gelatin, it says chondroitin sulfate, because you can't use brand names in a book. Okay, either something like lupus or fibromyalgia, or give me a name. Not yet. I never heard of that one. Okay, so you got a connective tissue disorder. It can be lupus. It could be fibromyalgia. These, in fact, are caused by mineral deficiencies. Fibromyalgia is essentially white muscle disease or stiff lamb disease. Farmers, what do you give for stiff lamb disease? Selenium, okay? So you want to use Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula. Don't let them give you cortisone and prednisone. If it's lupus, it's a deficiency of sulfur and copper. Use Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula the same way. Give up all vegetable oils and margarine and salad dressing. Yes, sir. Hemochromatosis, iron storage disease, all kinds of stuff like that. This is the big rage now. Don't supplement with iron, you know, they tell you. But I hope you don't listen to them, because most people who have hemochromatosis or iron storage disease have never, ever supplemented with iron. Right? Okay. Now, the reason why people get hemochromatosis and iron storage disease is not because you take in too much iron, you eat too much red meat, or supplement with iron. It's because you have a copper deficiency. You have a copper deficiency. You take all 90 nutrients, including colloidal copper, the hemochromatosis and iron storage disease will go away because you're getting that missing piece of the chemical reactions. Back here. Migraines are always food allergies. What you want to do for 1 month, keep a little book, a little spiral notebook in your pocket or purse, and every time you put food in your mouth, put great detail of the time in which you ate it and what you ate. If you ate pizza, don't just say pizza. You got to say everything that's on the pizza. And then write down the times at which migraine headaches appear. Don't look at the results. Don't try and interpret it until the end of a full month that goes by. Then go back with a yellow highlighter, highlight all the places where you had a migraine headache, and then go to the snack or the meal just before that. And you'll find a common thread. You eliminate that food out of your diet, you won't have migraines anymore. Yes, sir? Asthma is a deficiency of two minerals and essential fatty acid. The two minerals are magnesium and manganese, and essential fatty acids, which you can get from either flaxseed oil capsules, that's what I personally take, or fish oil. Cataracts, you catch them in the early stage, they are reversible with Dr. Wallach's Big Arthritis Formula because it contains three essential things, selenium, methionine, which is amino acid, sulfur-bearing amino acid, and vitamin E. But that's in the early stages. If they look like mothballs, then there is, you need surgery. It's too late. Yes? Okay, after a complete hysterectomy, no ovaries use, you do not need estrogen replacement. You give your adrenal glands and your liver all the raw materials they need, okay, which is the 90 nutrients plus cholesterol. You'll produce enough estrogen so you won't get any of the side effects, or if you do, there'll be minimal side effects of this instant menopause you get from hysterectomy. Sjogren's disease, okay, dry mouth, no tears or little tears. Always, this is due to a vitamin A deficiency. Always is due to a vitamin A deficiency. If you're not supplementing with vitamin A, do you take multivitamin minerals? No. Okay, it's a vitamin A deficiency. I don't have to say anymore. Okay, do you have an adrenal problem? Oh, I have a friend, okay. Yeah, they have an adrenal gland problem. They can have a tumor there. They might have a long-term series of prednisone or cortisone treatments, okay? Okay. No, they had a bad reaction to it. It might have been Cushing's disease, okay? And, of course, so what you want to do is give them all 90 nutrients. Give them Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula, whether it's the adrenal glands or the testicles, the ovaries, the pituitary, the thyroid. Something's missing there when those things happen. Dry skin, looks like he's been rolled in Rice Krispies. Yeah, okay. Yeah, this is called dry eczema. Sometimes it'll crack and bleed or ooze. Yeah, ugly. Okay, now this is due to an essential fatty acid deficiency. He needs to eat chicken skin, not fried, but roasted, baked, or broiled chicken skin. He also needs to eat fish 3 or 4 times a week, not fried, but roasted, baked, steamed, to get the essential fatty acids. He can also take the flaxseed oil capsules with breakfast, lunch, and supper. How old is the kid? 11. Okay, he's almost an adult. And then you can take Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula. But also, you want to get him off of all wheat because he probably has what's called celiac disease. the wheat gluten prevents the absorption of essential fatty acids, and you start seeing this eczema all over the body. Yes? Numbness in the feet could be due to dozens of things. It could be, for instance, due to B12 deficiency. It could be due to neuropathy from uncontrolled diabetes. It could be due to spinal stenosis, which is caused by, osteoporosis, where the vertebrae try to get stronger by growing big with connective tissue because they don't have enough minerals, and it begins to squish on the spinal nerves and the spinal cord. So it could be many things. You have to find out first what it is, and the book Let's Play Doctor will tell you how to do that. Okay, vitiligo is a loss of skin color and is due to a deficiency of folic acid and PABA, P-A-B-A, and you can actually take mega doses of those things and take all 90 essential nutrients and your skin color will come back next. I'm sorry? Oh, macular degeneration. Okay, this is where you get a degeneration of the retina of the eye. Okay, and this is due to a deficiency of three nutrients. Number one, it's a deficiency of a special amino acid, which you have to go to a health food store and get this amino acid in 500 milligram capsules. It's called taurine, T-A-U-R-I-N-E. Then selenium and vitamin E. You also have to give up vegetable oils and salad dressing and all fried foods. Hay fever. Okay, miserable hay fever. You may not be able to totally get rid of it, but if you want to reduce it significantly, what you have to do is go on a rotation diet. In other words, don't eat the same food every day. Don't eat bread every day. Don't eat hamburgers every day. Don't eat eggs every day. You have to eat foods once every third day or once every fifth day. It's called a rotation diet. Now, you want to take some digestive aids to kind of reduce all the possibility of undigested proteins and things like that causing stress on your immune system. Then you want to make sure the individual takes all 90 nutrients so their immune system is up to where they can defend themselves. It's a big process, but is it worth it? Yes. Parasites. You're talking about worms or little one-celled things? All parasites. Okay, well, it's a big field. The one-celled things, of course, if you take all 90 nutrients and you take some oxygen, either the food-grade hydrogen peroxide in drops in distilled water, or we have a product called OxyTati that has 20 drops of the 35% each ounce of aloe vera juice, very frequently just oxygenating the bowels is enough to kill out the one-cell parasites. The worms, what I like to do, if you wanted to use herbs, there's things like wormwood and black walnut hulls, you can round up, you can get in capsules and health food stores, that works pretty good. What I used to do with my kids is I'd give them sheep warmer. Okay, Parkinson's disease. I'll cover three diseases at one time here. MS, multiple sclerosis, ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and Parkinson's disease, they all seem to have the same cause, a mercury poisoning, causing damage to the brain, causing damage to the cholesterol part of the brain, the myelin coating of the nerve trunks. There's two ways that you can get mercury. Number one, you get it from your mercury amalgam fillings, and so you want to get all the mercury fillings out. The other way is the most common trade that gets Parkinson's disease is farmers, because they deal with mercury-coated seed grains to prevent molding of the seeds in the soil. Farmers, yeah. And so what you want to do is get all the mercury out of your life, and then you want to take Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula, because it has colloidal selenium in it, which is a specific antidote to dump stored mercury in your brain, liver, and other tissues. And lastly, get a hold of a book called Dr. Swank's Diet for MS, and it's good for Parkinson's disease, ALS, and MS. Yes. Okay, pernicious anemia is a B12 deficiency. Is this in a young person or a senior? Okay, do you have belching, burping, and bloating? Yes, okay, good, very honest lady. And now, the reason why you have pernicious anemia or B12 deficiency anemia and you have belching, burping, and bloating, they always go together, is because you don't have enough stomach acid in your stomach, and you cannot absorb B12 without a very acid stomach. Diabetes. Okay, diabetes, adult-onset diabetes is a chromium and vanadium deficiency. Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula and another product we have called Sugar Ease has the chelated form of chromium and vanadium. I've literally seen thousands of people who had adult-onset diabetes, including my own 82-year-old father-in-law who'd been on insulin for 20 years, over a period of 3.5 months, actually been able to wean off of his insulin, just simply by taking in the colloidal form of chromium and vanadium. It's just very simple. And, of course, diabetics are trained to monitor their blood sugar. They're trained to monitor and take care of their insulin requirements on a day-to-day basis. So you're in a very good position. If, for instance, you wake up in the morning and your blood sugar is 50, Would you take insulin that morning? No, obviously not. And so if your blood sugar comes down, you can begin to slowly wean off of your insulin or reduce your insulin, and you're trained how to do that. Manic depression. Okay, manic depression. Depression, bipolar disease, hyperactivity, ADD, ADHD, all of these kind of emotional things have the same approach nutritionally. Number one, you want to give up all sugar, natural and processed. No apple juice, no grape juice, no honey, no molasses, no processed sugar, no donuts, no candy, no sugar frosted flakes, you know, nothing like that. Even hot dogs have corn syrup in them. You got to read labels and exclude all that. Then you want to take Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula because it has lithium, chromium, and vanadium in it. Okay. Childhood diabetes. Okay. Childhood or juvenile onset diabetes. That all the research shows that these individuals are allergic to dairy. And the beta cells in the islet of Langerhans that produce the insulin, the cell membrane is in fact, it has a similar amino acid sequence as does milk protein. And so almost always these people are allergic to milk. And so you got to get them off of dairy, get this antibody thing that's going crazy against milk to disappear so it won't attack their own beta cells. And then, of course, you need to take chromium and vanadium. And there's no reason why these kids can't live to be 100 if they take chromium and vanadium. And Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula is a good source. And get off of dairy. They have to be good. They have to have a sugar-free diet and do the diabetic thing. And if they're good, there's no reason why they can't live to be 100. Yes, the purple. Pulmonary hypertension. Okay. Usually these are people with some kind of obstructive disease. Okay. You have chronic pulmonary obstructive disease of one kind or asthma. Emphysema, and of course, as a result, the pressure, the blood pressure goes up as a result of the chronic lung disease, correct? Okay. I'm sorry? Yeah, heart and lung disease. Do you have cystic fibrosis? No? Okay, well, again, I would treat yourself like asthma nutritionally. What I would do is take Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula for the manganese and magnesium. I would take essential fatty acids. I would take 3 of those 1,000-milligram capsules for breakfast, lunch, and supper for a total of 9 a day. Give up all sugar, give up all caffeine, absolutely no fats or vegetable oils in your diet except for the essential fatty acids, which you're going to supplement with. No salad dressing, no deep-fried foods, absolutely none. Yes, ma'am. Neurofibromatosis, elephant man disease. I don't know enough about that when it comes to nutrition, but if I had the disease or had a patient with it, when I've never had a patient with it, and I've always wanted to try this, was use Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula with it because really, what it looks like to me is a form of Paget's disease, especially with all the bone deformities in the skull and the large bones of the arms and so forth. It looks like Paget's disease, a form of Paget's disease, which occurs mostly in males. And I would like to try Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula for 3 months. You have everything to gain, nothing to lose by trying it. A low temperature? Is that Wilson syndrome? Okay, nothing else is low temperature? Okay, that's usually thyroid gland stuff. If you want to get your temperature up, take some cayenne pepper. It'll rise right up quickly. But also take the 90 nutrients, which will stimulate the thyroid gland and get yourself going. But do the half a teaspoon of cayenne and then work up to a teaspoon a day in hot water. Yes, in the red. Okay, what's the difference between minerals and medicinal herbs? This is a very good question. Medicinal herbs are plant medicines. They drive your body to do things. If you're constipated, it'll loosen you up. If you're diarrhea, it'll tighten you up. If you have high blood pressure, it can bring it down. But if you get off the herbs, that blood pressure goes back up. It doesn't cure anything. They're medicines that make your body do things. Minerals actually fit into the biochemistry of each cell in your body and are required to prevent diseases. Herbs are not required to prevent diseases. Herbs will work better if you take minerals, because your body can more uniformly respond to these herbs or acupuncture or chiropractic or whatever it might be. Okay, psoriasis, up until a year ago, I didn't have a good answer for that. But here's what I've learned. Number one, they need to take Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula twice a day, add in the flaxseed oil capsules to make sure they get all 90 nutrients. And that'll improve psoriasis about 40%. The scales will drop off, the skin will get nice and pink underneath instead of fiery red and all cracked and bleeding and everything. And then, what you want to do is puree a big Bermuda onion, skin it and puree it, put it in a bowl, then puree a big cucumber, skin it and puree it. Take the Bermuda onion puree, smear it on the psoriasis lesions and sores, and it'll sting like you put alcohol in a cup. In about 5 minutes, it'll stop stinging. You wipe it off. Don't wash it off. Wipe it off. Put on the pureed cucumber. That will sting. And when that stops stinging, wipe that off. Put on a good collagen cream. Leave it on there all day. And then 2 hours before you go to bed, go through the onion and the cucumber thing again and sleep all night with the collagen cream on. And in about a month or two, the psoriasis will go away. You have to keep repeating that treatment about every couple of months, but it'll keep it away. And every time you see a little dime-sized spot show up, you hit it again with that treatment. Chronic cold sores, herpes simplex virus. Again, if you have things like jock itch and vaginal yeast infections, you have fungus in your toenails, athlete's foot, herpes, those kinds of things, it means your own immune system doesn't have enough strength to keep all these little things away from you, which most people are able to do. And so you want to take Dr. Wong's Pig Arthritis Formula twice a day. Give your immune system all the nutrients it needs. Okay, prostate. Okay, well, let's start out first with prostate. 80% of all men over the age of 50 in America have an enlarged prostate. Whenever you get a statistic like that, it tells you it's a nutritional problem. They're missing minerals, okay? Get them on Dr. Wallach's Pig Arthritis Formula. We have another one called Rainforest Toddy, which has a herb in it called saw palmetto, which will actually shrink the prostate gland. And then prostate cancer, in addition to taking all 90 nutrients to get your immune system up, you also want to take some shark cartilage, okay, which prevents the spread of the prostate cancer into the bone. One of the interesting things, if the person is over 60 years of age, all of these statistics show that they should not get chemotherapy or radiation because they will live 12 to 15 years if they're over 60 with the prostate cancer. And, of course, to get chemotherapy or radiation, the average lifespan is 5 years. And so you're very sane not to take it. Oh, you're still coughing? Okay, 2 years ago, you had walking pneumonia and you're still coughing. Okay, well, you might have some scar tissue or damage, or you might have chronic bronchitis, okay, all kinds of possibilities in there. And did you plow fields and work in dust and chemicals and things like that? What did you do for a living? No, what did you do for a living? Oh, Jesus. There's no hope. Okay, basically what you want to do is take Dr. Wallach's Pig Arthritis Formula and be sure to take the essential fatty acids in the form of flaxseed oil. You also want to look at taking the OxyTotty for the oxygen supplement. Okay, post-polio syndrome kind of thing? Yeah, okay. Huh? Yeah, but did he get polio vaccine? Yeah, he's shaking his head yes. Okay, so it could have been from that. Now, the thing to do, the best thing he can do for himself is take Dr. Wallach's Pig Arthritis Formula twice a day. And the reason why I say that so much is saying, this Wallach is selling snake oil. You know, every time somebody asks for a different disease, I'm going to take Dr. Wallach's Pig Arthritis Formula. It contains 87 nutrients. Remember, there's 10 diseases for each nutrient. 10 times 87 is 870 different diseases are going to be covered by that formula. Endometriosis, you're not going to fix that with nutrition, but there is a posterior pituitary hormone which you can get from the OB. It's a prescription. It's called Luperon. Endometriosis and also the fibroids in the uterus. You can shrink those things with the Luperon. And you can get them down from big, you know, the size of a grapefruit down to the size of your little fingernail. And you can go in through your belly button with endoscopic tools and snip that thing off of there without having to get a hysterectomy. Neurological problems? Sure. B1 deficiency, B12 deficiency, calcium deficiency. Copper deficient, there's all kinds of them. So the best thing to do, don't try and pick one out, take them all. Get off of all sugar. Gout. Okay, gout, you want to stay on the diet. No beans, no seafood, no lentils, that kind of stuff. No wine, no beer, no yeast. And if you do that faithfully, you won't get very many flare-ups during the year, maybe none. But if you do get a flare-up, there's two things you can do. Number one, there's an herb called meadow saffron. It is a natural source of colchicin, which is the drug of choice by medical doctors for gout. You can also, of course, take a vitamin called folic acid. You want to take large amounts of this, 20 milligrams a day during a flare-up, and it drives your liver to gobble up all that uric acid. Okay, repeated miscarriages almost always is due to a deficiency disease of something. It could be selenium, could be zinc, could be copper, could be vitamin A, could be vitamin E. And of course, I always say that I've gotten more women pregnant than any other man on earth because I've literally had thousands and thousands of cases like this where women are infertile. They get going, they get a miscarriage somewhere along the line. And what they do is take Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula faithfully. My own daughter is a great story. She's 34 years old, been married 12 years, and they tried and tried and tried and couldn't get a pregnancy. And against my best advice to her, she and her husband went around the world to all the experts in Europe and France and England and went to the Mayo Clinic and said, hold the Mayo, don't even go there. You know, and after 12 years of searching and trying, they were told that she was hopelessly sterile, couldn't have any children. And she came to me in tears. It looks like we're going to have to adopt a baby. And I said, well, look, why don't you try Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula for 6 months before you make that decision? 3 months later, she called me and said, Dad, I'm pregnant. I said, why didn't you do that before you spent $150,000? She says, well, they were experts. Yes, ma'am. Hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, is the first symptom of diabetes. It's on the same curve. It's the earliest symptoms of diabetes. If you don't deal with low blood sugar, if you just try to deal with it by regulating your diet and avoiding sugar, you're going to get diabetes, as sure as God made little green apples. And so what you want to do, in addition to not taking in any sugar, doctors say, oh, you get low blood sugar, eat a candy bar. That's the wrong thing to do. What you want to do is eat about 5 or 6 small meals a day. I've had people with such bad low blood sugar or hypoglycemia, I had them just go to McDonald's and get nothing but the hamburger patty. They'd get a dozen of them at a time. And they would eat 2 hamburger patties. And an hour later, they'd eat another 2 hamburger patties. 2 hours later, they'd eat another 2 hamburger patties. But you also want to take Dr. Wallach's pig arthritis formula because it's got the chromium and vanadium in it. That'll take care of this body's inability to deal with blood sugar, regulate things, and get you out of trouble. Yes, ma'am. Okay, muscle spasms in the back after an accident. Doesn't matter if a horse has jumped on you, a car accident, plane accident, or you're just whacking around a little bit.
Well, that's it for tonight, folks. There's just a couple of more questions, and so you're not missing much. I think you got the gist of it. If you'd like to get more information about Dr. Wallach and how he can help you improve your own personal health, call 1-888-403-2405. That's 1-888-403-2405. Or 1-888-701-0502. That's 1-888-701-0502. For all those of you who have sent in and received your little info pack and paid your $6, it doesn't do you, me, or anybody in this world any good unless you buy these products and use them. And remember, if you paid your $6, you're entitled to the wholesale price. You can buy one bottle or a case of bottles, but you're entitled to the wholesale price. The wholesale price. Okay, that's why we do it that way. We didn't have to do it that way. We could sell it to you for the retail price. And then you'd pay out the nose and we wouldn't feel good. So, but you don't have to become a preferred customer or a distributor. You don't have to do any of that. You can pay the full retail price and talk to Tim at the number when you call and find out how to do that if you don't want to do anything else except just buy the products. Okay? Once again, here's the numbers, 1-888-403-2405 or 1-888-701-0502. That's 1-888-403-2405, 1-888-701-0502. Good night, folks, and God bless each and every single one of you. Nothing can ever save the love I have for you.